Today is Tuesday, August 31st, 2021. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for asking. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. You left off last part two. You had finished your PhD and had taken a job in Belmont. I get confused whether it's Belmont, Tennessee, or whether it's Belmont College.
It's Belmont College in Nashville, Tennessee.
Got it. That's where I get stumbled up. Belmont College in Nashville in 1969. Can you pick that thread up?
Yes. So I finished up University of Alabama, PhD in August of 69, and at the end of the month, I loaded up the kids and moved to Nashville and started to work at Belmont College on the 1st of September, 1970.
Okay. What can you tell me about Belmont?
Well, it was a small, small liberal arts college, and it was basically a Baptist college.
Okay.
And 4 years, no master's programs. And I went there, and I was really excited about it because I'm living in Tennessee for the first time, and I'm thinking all these places to go and explore and fish and catch and whatever.
Oh, fun.
But I got there, and then I found out I had a job to do.
Okay.
And teaching load was fairly heavy.
Oh, my. Okay.
And I was also chairman of the department.
Ooh.
And that was, so here I just graduate, and I turn out to be the department chair. And there were like, I think, four or five other people in the department. And I just basically had to dig in and sort of take over and try to manage. And I realized actually by the end of the first semester that I am not happy here.
Okay.
And part of that was I lived out on the Stones River, which is in East Nashville, and Belmont is downtown to the west of downtown Nashville.
Okay.
So the commute was just terrible. It's the first time I've had a commute like that. It's like 30, 40 minutes in traffic each way.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it was before they had a lot of the interstate system and expressways completed around Nashville, so it was pretty slow go. And
so that's an hour and a half burned up right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Every day.
And I just realized I had no time for research, and all those beautiful streams around Nashville I wanted to explore, I didn't have time for that because I was preparing lectures and grading papers and trying to remodel labs that were totally inadequate and out of date, which I did. And I guess it's sometime in the spring semester I thought, I'm looking for a job.
Okay.
I can't do this. So
I'm going to, can I back up just a minute? I mean,
sure.
The department chair is a very important position.
Mm-hmm.
Department chair has to deal with all the interdepartment politics.
Oh,
Has to fight for the department with senior management. That's a heavy load to drop into.
Yeah.
Right out the gate.
The situation was interesting in that the faculty I had in the department. One was a PhD microbiologist. One was a PhD physiologist, and both of them had been there. Well, one of them had been there 1 year, and the other had been there 2 years.
Okay.
And then I had a guy there that had retired from Western Kentucky University, and he was the department chair at Western Kentucky. But he said, Jim, I'm so tired of administration. I never want to talk to another dean as long as I live.
Wow.
I want to teach biology.
Okay.
So that was Dr. Stevens.
Okay.
And so here I am just graduating. And I'm supervising somebody. Well, I wasn't really supervising, but he was in my department. And he did. He helped out a lot.
I bet he would be a wonderful resource.
Yeah, he was. He was in fact one of the things that got me through the year.
Mm.
And then I had a couple of guys with master's degrees and been there for a year, 2 years. They had a lot of turnover.
I see, yeah.
And okay. So basically they brought me in because they didn't want to upset the other two young PhDs that had been there for 1 and 2 years,
right,
respectively. And so it's like, okay, I'll deal with this. And and it did pay a few $100 a year more than otherwise. So I was all for that. And but yeah, and the fact that it was a Baptist college, I grew up in a Baptist church and mm-hmm. been baptized in Baptist church, but I was not an active churchgoer. And that was not required, of course. It was wide open. And but I was expected to show up at chapel every Wednesday morning and sit on the front row. I didn't do, and the dean called me in after a couple of months and said, gee, you know, we know you're busy, Jim, getting settled and everything, but we've really been missing you at chapel. So I'm like, well, you know, I'm trying to remodel the labs in the department. I'm trying to, you know, first year out, I said, I've just got a lot on my plate.
Yeah,
And they sort of understood. And I really liked the people there were great.
Mm.
I couldn't say enough good things about them. It was just the situation I was in.
Right.
And part of it is, I think, with any PhD student that gets out and goes into a teaching position, you don't realize how often Monday, Wednesday, Friday lectures show up. You don't have all those notes prepared for those lectures.
Right.
And so it takes time.
That's right.
And but
especially your first year in.
Yeah.
You gotta make it all from scratch or borrow from somebody else and
So I knew sometime mid semester, spring semester, March, that I was not going to be there for another year. I had to find another job.
Okay.
And I told my wife, Anna, and it was, she was okay with it, depending on where we were moving to. And so I started applying for jobs on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I attended the Southeastern, Association of Southeastern Biologists meetings. I think they were in April that year. And that was actually the month that my daughter was born. So I had been scheduled to go to those. I didn't make it because Dana came along.
Okay.
And but I did get, after a few phone calls, feedback that there was an opening at Mississippi State College for Women in Columbus, Mississippi.
Hmm.
And that's right on the banks of the Tom Bigbee River. It's 25 miles from Starkville, Mississippi State University, and it's only 60 miles west of Tuscaloosa, University of Alabama.
Cool.
I thought, I think I'll try that. So I put my name in the hat, and I got the job. So I had a contract I'd signed through summer school, and I taught, in fact, I think the first term of summer school at Belmont. And then sort of the second term was the process of packing up and moving and leaving. And so by the end of August of 1970, I was on my way to Mississippi State College for Women.
Okay.
In Columbus, Mississippi.
And you were going to teach just straight up biology there?
Yep, just straight biology, no administrative duties. And Mississippi State College for Women was it was an all-girls school. It had about 2,000 students. It was fairly well-funded. They had really nice facilities.
Hmm.
And
what was the commute like?
Oh, it was, I could walk.
Nice.
I could walk to class, yes. And in fact, we lived in faculty housing.
Okay.
Which was the university, because housing was so limited in Columbus, Mississippi at that point, that the university invested in faculty housing, which were very nice condos, very large, in fact, almost as large as the house I was in Nashville.
Hmm.
And it was a three-bedroom apartment, and I say apartment, condo, and a huge living room and a fairly sizable dining area and a nice kitchen, and they were new, so it was really nice.
Gosh,
and,
it quite like you died and gone to heaven with that job.
Absolutely, and the nice thing about it was almost like grad school again, because you have all these people living there. They're faculty at the college. They all were young, and they all had kids.
Okay.
So we had cookouts, community cookouts in the backyard, going to buildings, and it was a really pleasant atmosphere, and I really liked it.
Did they have a master's PhD program, or was it just undergrad?
They had a master's program.
Okay.
And that was the other thing that was nice, because I thought, ha-ha, I can get grad students here, and I can do master's research, and that'll be great.
Cool.
And so that got things started, and I guess by this time I was beginning to realize that a lot of the things that I loved about my work was outdoors, natural history, the natural beauty of an undisturbed riverine habitat or creek habitat.
Okay.
And I sort of stumbled into the Corps of Engineers were building or planning to build the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway. And the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway was designed to connect the Tennessee River, which was a tributary of the Mississippi River eventually, and the Tom Bigbee River flowed directly into the Mobile River in the Gulf of Mexico through Mobile.
Okay.
So these are two different aquatic worlds. And they're proposing to connect these two different worlds with this waterway.
Hmm.
And so I got involved with a group at Mississippi State University, and it was called CLEAN. And CLEAN was an acronym for Committee for Leaving the Environment of America Natural. And it was a group of environmental activists, and also you have to realize in 1970, 71 along in there was when a lot of the environmental movement was just really getting up and running.
That's right. NEPA was just coming online.
Yep, exactly.
Wilderness Act had passed.
Clean Water Act was passed in 72.
Yep, okay.
And NEPA was coming online. And so I wound up getting very actively involved in the 10-Tom Waterway controversy, and eventually got myself elected chairman of CLEAN. And so about a year into my stay there, we had attracted the attention of the Environmental Defense Fund in New York.
Huh.
And so we basically put together a lawsuit, which was Environmental Defense Fund, which provided the legal expertise.
Right.
But they needed a local group and individuals. So
yeah,
the group
yeah.
was CLEAN, and I was a local individual, as
okay.
an individual plaintiff.
All right.
So this is when I got a real lesson in civics. I figured out that, boy, I have really kicked the hornet's nest here. And
okay.
there was Senator Stennis from Mississippi and Senator Eastland from Mississippi. And the two of them did not take kindly to this young upstart professor at one of their universities in their state suing the Corps of Engineers and messing around with their project, their
Ooh.
Pork Barrel project. And believe me, it was pork barrel.
Okay.
It's probably one of the biggest pork barrels ever in this entire country.
Interesting.
They originally had it planned to cost less than $300 million. And it wound up costing over $1 billion.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah, $1 billion. And basically was a barge canal to connect two rivers. But they had no commodities except coal, maybe, and maybe a little bit of pulpwood, maybe some gravel.
Wow.
They were clamoring to dig up anything they could to ship up and down that river.
Hmm.
And it was going to be a, quote, shortcut to the Gulf of Mexico, and which it would have been if they had anything to ship on it. And we caught them in all sorts of lies, like they said we're going to ship all this coal out of East Tennessee, And we started looking into that, and it turns out they had calculated all the tons of coal that existed in East Tennessee, a lot of which was not mineable with any kind of reasonable techniques, because you might have a seam that was 3 feet thick that went for, 20 square miles, but you had 150 feet of sandstone, slate, shale, or whatever on top of it,
mm-hmm.
and there's no way to get it that 3 feet in there to get it out.
Right.
So,
wow.
Economically, anyway.
Yeah, no, and, so they were really pumping the figures.
Oh, yeah, they were just totally, totally. So, anyway, we filed the lawsuit, Environmental Expense Funds did, in New York, or, I'm sorry, in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And because that's headquarters of the Corps, and we had the first hearing before the judge. We claimed, by the way, this was a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, because they had not explored all the impacts that their project was going to have on the waterway.
Okay, clear enough.
We took their environmental impact statement and really ripped it to shreds. So we won an injunction.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, we won an injunction to stop the project until the Corps got an adequate environmental impact statement. Well, along in there is where the two senators from Mississippi decided they had had enough. So in March of, that would have been 1972.
Right.
They basically sent out letters with contracts. Well, my contract that they gave me in that spring of 72 for the next school year was for one semester only. And I was terminated after that one semester.
Hmm.
And, of course, in academics, you can't, if you're looking for a job, it's usually September through August
for
the next year. And so by cutting me off in the middle of the school year, they basically told me to get the hell out now because, I mean, what chance would I have of finding an opening teaching in a university in the middle of the school year?
Right.
Just almost impossible.
Right.
So they didn't fire me, but they gave me a half-year contract. So I started looking, and Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, also a Baptist college, by the way. I went there, interviewed, and was applying for a job that my college grad school office mate had vacated because he got a job outside, moved away to another university.
Hmm.
And so Mike and I had identical backgrounds. And I went over, nailed the interview, nailed the seminar, and I thought, got the job. We're moving to Birmingham, honey. And Mike didn't call me on Tuesday or Wednesday the next week, and I waited till Friday and called him and said, "What's up?" He said, "I don't know, Jim. I think there's a problem." And the problem was there was a state representative in Alabama, a U.S. representative, for the Birmingham area that found out that this guy that had sued the Corps was applying for that job, and there was no way that Belmont College, he wasn't going to allow Belmont College to hire somebody, even though it was an independent Baptist college. He was a churchgoer, and he was a big supporter of the university, and he helped them out when he could with, projects that were funded through the federal government,
mm-hmm.
budget, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, they said, "No, we can't hire you."
Wow.
And they didn't tell me why. They just said, "No, you didn't get the job."
Uh-huh.
So then I go to Georgia College at Milledgeville, Georgia. They had an opening for a biologist. And my major professor, Dr. Beauchamp, knew the department chair. And I applied there, but they were getting a lot of money from Georgia Power.
Okay.
For a research station that they had on one of the reservoirs. And basically came down, they were afraid that would jeopardize their funding from Georgia Power because here's somebody that doesn't like dams.
Right.
And so I did the interview, and everything went well. I was doing fine with my interviews and meeting people. I was solid. Yeah, I had all the credentials I needed. And but once again, didn't get it. By this time, I'm getting a little bit worried.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to do here with, you know, a wife and a couple of kids, and all of a sudden I don't have a job. And it was around the end of May, towards the end of the semester, a friend of mine who was teaching at Auburn told me about an opening at Tuskegee Institute.
Okay.
In Tuskegee, Alabama. And that's a historically black college.
Mm-hmm.
And I was familiar with it. And so I quick got my credentials together, and he'd given me the name of the department chair, Dr. Walter Sapp. And so I sent Dr. Sapp my credentials. And the opening, I should add, was actually this friend of mine's wife. And she was leaving because she had some health issues.
Okay.
And they also had a small child, and she couldn't deal with health issues.
Right.
So she stayed home, decided to stay home, and that opened up the position. So basically when I went over to interview, I said, look, I must tell you, and being honest and upfront about things, I am involved in a lawsuit with the Corps of Engineers, but it will not distract at all from my teaching responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, Walter Sapp said, well, what the hell? Said, you want to go there and protest? We'll get a busload of students. I thought, my God, I found my home.
I finally found my home
in a historically black college.
Wow.
Somebody that knows about controversy and appreciates people who stand up to it.
Yeah.
And, take on the Corps of Engineers. So, that was one of my, I tell you, I love those people. It was like, this is bright. I mean, and I got there, and it was really great. The department was about as international as you could get.
Wow.
We had black professors. We had Indian, a couple of people from India that were professors. We had one from Japan. I mean, and as I like to tell it, there was a guy there. His last name was Williams. From Louisiana, we considered him the Cajun in the family. And it was just a great department. I loved it.
Nice.
The best 2 years of teaching that I had in my 5 years of teaching.
Wow.
And it brought back some memories that I had from the University of Alabama when I was there. I was there when George Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door. And that was quite, this is kind of going back to my grad school days, but I think it's important then that I had been born and raised in a segregated South. I knew only segregated schools. I'd never attended schools with black kids. I grew up in Lincoln, Alabama around black kids, but they went to their school and we went to our school.
Mm-hmm.
And I never questioned that. I think about it now and it's like, my God, how could you not question that?
Right.
And it was just the way things were, and I didn't. I just accepted it. And it was not until I witnessed George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama in the summer of 1963 that I realized, oh my God, this is wrong. This is totally wrong. Where the hell have I been?
Hmm.
It was a really moment for me in my whole thinking of society that I'd never stopped to think about.
Interesting.
I was always about me.
Uh-huh.
And what I was going to do and where I was going and what I was going to do, I never really stopped to think about this. And it really, I found it surprising, somewhat shocking. And it's like, how can I have not said something? I mean, this is just crazy.
So you would have been 22, 23 when the light bulb went on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But it took a situation where there was a confrontation, and I might add, that summer, which was the second time the university had that attempted integration there, went off quite smoothly.
Hmm.
It attracted news trucks from all over. But the president of the university there was the reason it happened the way it did. He had the registration take place in the summer because you have fewer students on campus. But before he did that, before the registration, they closed off the center of the campus to everyone except people who could, who had privileges on the university campus, like either work there, faculty or staff, support staff, or students. Those were the only people allowed on the campus. So we didn't have a lot of outside people coming from 50, 100 miles around to go to the campus to, you know, stir up trouble.
Okay.
And the next thing they did, they went through all the buildings and removed Coke machines and replaced them with the bottle machines with cup machines. So there were no bottles for anybody to throw.
Okay.
They picked up every stick and stone on campus. And it turns out it wasn't necessary. It went off quite smoothly. Yeah. And then by the fall semester, there were several other students, black students, that arrived and registered, and things went off without a hitch.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really a turning point, and I thought, when I was at Tuskegee, I thought, this is, I mean, I just, what an experience I had there. First time in my life, I worked in a situation where I was a minority, and you get a feeling of what it's like.
Yeah.
You know, it's just different. But my kids, we lived on a street that was fully integrated. My kids played with the black family next door to us. And we were in a rental property, mm-hmm. big house. But the house next door was the principal of one of the local schools. He was
cool.
black. And
cool.
He had kids, my kids' age, so uh-huh. they all played together.
Cool.
And it was just it was a great experience for the family and myself. And I loved my 2 years at Tuskegee. It was really and I got a lot of work done. I had a grad student, a master's student. And so it worked out really well. And but I was there for 2 years in Tuskegee, and it was in the spring of, I guess it would be 1974. That spring, I got a call from, because of my involvement in the 10-time Waterway case, I had made a lot of connections, and a lot of people had noticed my name and said, oh, this is that guy down there that participated in a lawsuit against the Corps of Engineers. Well, there was an opening in the Endangered Species Office in Washington, D.C., and, of course, my wife, Anna, was from Washington. So when I told her about it, she said, you've got to apply. I want to go back to Washington.
So hang on a second. Wait. Let's go back a little bit. Just tie up some loose ends. So you got an injunction against the Corps, and they had to go back and rework their environmental impact statement.
Correct.
What happened? What was, because basically, if I get this right, and I'm not a biologist, what they wanted to do was connect species in one watershed with species in another watershed.
Correct.
And if they hadn't looked at that for adverse consequences, the whole project would have had to stop.
Right.
So what was the outcome of that? What happened?
Well, that was one of our big arguments. If they had not looked at the impact of this exchange of faunas between these two totally different, there's some widespread species, largemouth bass occur in both, long-nosed gar occur in both, but there are a lot of things that don't occur in both of those systems. So what's going to happen when you mix them?
Right.
And they basically said, oh, they'll get along. There might be a little bit of hybridization, but we don't expect any adverse impacts from that. And it just, and I'll be honest with you, a lot of it is because of our ignorance of what was there.
Oh.
And
wow.
We didn't know everything that was there. And we only found that out, freshwater mussel-wise, later on. And but we did manage to... We made them go back and reworked their environmental impact statement.
Okay.
They did. And in the meantime, they got the change of venue from Washington, D.C. down to the Northern District of Mississippi.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's when I learned another civics lesson, that district judges, federal judges, only get to the next step for them, which is Court of Appeals, which in this case would have been New Orleans. They only get to New Orleans from the Northern District of Mississippi when the senator from Mississippi can get them appointed to that position and confirmed through the Senate And that's a presidential appointment. And then, of course, they have to be confirmed by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And
so a lot of politics right there.
Yeah, absolutely. So we basically lost the case against the court. We argued in the Northern District of Mississippi, and that was in the summer. I think that was like in July, August, somewhere along in there of 72, before I moved to Tuskegee in September, August, late August. But we didn't hear about the judge. They didn't make a decision because he took it all under advisement. It wasn't a trial. It was just a judge hearing the case.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't hear about it until the next spring, actually. It went over the winter and into April, I think it was, when we got the and by that time, I'm in Tuskegee, and we were ruled against, so the Corps free to dig their ditch, or start digging their ditch. And when they did that, I went in to see Walt Sapp, my department chair, one day. I said, Walt, I said, I'm going over, I'm going to take a day off. I'm gonna, on Friday, I said, I'm going to go over there and see what they're doing, see what it looks like. They've been over there digging for a month or so, and he was more than happy, and he said, you know, if you need, you know, if you want to take some students over there, show them what's going on, whatever. As I recall, I took a couple of students with me, and we drove cool. over to look at it, and it was like I explained to them, you know, this is what they're doing, and this is what's bad about it. And so I was well supported at Tuskegee by my department chair and by the whole. In fact, while I was there, I was only there 2 years, but I did get a small NSF grant to look at freshwater mussels in the river, and that's where I got my start in freshwater mussels. I had never looked at a mussel until I got to the Tom Bigby. And the reason I got into them there was there were places we'd be out sampling fish on the river, and it's like, here's a mound of shell.
Wow.
That's a muskrat midden.
Oh, wow.
That was like bushels of fresh shell just laying there. I mean, they'd all been eaten by the muskrat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, God, look at these. And I'd never seen that many in one place at one time, because that's my first real work in a big river. And Tom Bigby's a big river. First real work there. And it's like, whoa, these things, well, there are lots of different variety species here.
Huh.
So I made that leap into the mussel world during my second year of work in Columbus, Mississippi.
So take me down that rabbit hole just a little further.
Mm-hmm.
Did they build this barge canal to actually connect these rivers up?
Oh yeah, they did.
And what happened to the mussels?
Well,
on the Bigby,
the ones on the Tom Bigby were endemic to the Mobile Basin.
Okay.
And the Mobile Basin, again, is everything that drains into Mobile Bay, and that includes headwaters of the Coosa, Alabama system, which start all the way up in North Georgia and a little bitty teeny bit of Tennessee.
Hmm.
And then on the west side, the Tom Bigby Blackwater side, to the west, that starts in northeast Mississippi, and of course goes back into Alabama and Mobile Bay. So that area is a unique aquatic system. In fact, it's called, some of us treat it like the Amazon of the South.
Oh, wow.
It's got so much diversity in it. And the rates of endemism in fishes, mussels, crayfishes, snails, is just off the scale. It's really high, high endemism. So a lot of these things were, in the Tom Bigby, were mussels that lived throughout the Mobile Basin. But then they had already dammed up every river in the system.
Hmm.
Either the Corps had or the Alabama Power had.
Wow.
This was the last large free-flowing coastal plain river in the Mobile Basin, and they destroyed it.
Wow.
With a 10-ton waterway. And it was a total boondoggle project, and it's the most awful thing. It still upsets me to this day.
Hmm.
And it's just something that the American people lost a lot of money. No one in Mississippi made a lot of money off of it, past the contractors that built it and left.
Right.
And it's there today. know it's not coming. We told you that.
Right. So that waterway is still there. It basically has little use, but I'm sure that there's people managing the water and doing lock work, and there's some jobs there tied to that.
Yeah, not a lot, though, because it's little traffic.
Not a lot. But there it sits, using probably federal funding to keep it going.
Absolutely.
So it's another one of those water projects that really needs to get shut down.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating.
Exactly.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, it's nowhere near any kind of a good cost-benefit ratio.
Huh, right.
In other words, cost of operating the lock and the benefits you derive from it don't add up.
Right.
Don't add up. It'd be better to give the people on the waterway a check from the federal government every year and shut the damn thing down.
Uh-huh.
Just walk away from it.
Yeah.
But
fascinating.
Filling up with concrete.
Okay. So then let's go over, you mentioned, this job, you heard about this job with the Endangered Species Office in Washington, D.C. Now, which department was running that office?
Okay. That's the, Department of the Interior.
Okay.
And Interior, that would come down to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Fish and Wildlife. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And, they, the office was a sort of a new fledgling operation because, of course, the act was only passed in December of 73, and I get there and start to work on the 3rd of September, 1974, and so the office had only been around for a few months, literally. And
wow.
We were just in the process of building it up, staffing it up.
Okay.
And, so it was all a new operation, and... that was, at the time, located downtown D.C., 1612 K Street, in fact, downtown D.C. It was just an office building because they didn't have room in the Interior Department to start a whole new program, so they put us in an office building.
Okay.
And it turned out to be a fortuitous location because it was near offices of the National Wildlife Federation. The Friends of the Earth, Sierra Club, and Audubon, a lot of the environmental groups that we had interactions with on the side.
Okay.
Some people in the department had trouble with that, I might add. But they were providing us with information and wanting to know why we weren't doing something with this species or that species.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of interaction with them. And frankly, they ran interference for us. If there was, there was somebody in the department that was taking a shortcut by not either treating a petition right or not doing the right thing, we sort of let them know, and they magically be called out.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
It was a good place.
So that's helpful. Let's back up a little bit to Dr. Sapp and the Tuskegee Institute. I'm assuming that you would have had your teaching feet under you.
Yes, I did by then. Yeah.
And it sounded like a wonderful place to work. Why again would you think about leaving there?
Well, I had been involved in this lawsuit, and I saw the Endangered Species Act, and I thought, this has teeth.
Ah.
This thing will work.
Okay.
And I know about these endangered mussels now, the Tom Bigby.
Right.
And I'm going to Washington, and I'm going to list them. And then we'll, see what we can do with the waterway from there. And it really took on, the Endangered Species Act is what made me move, basically.
Okay.
And the fact, I admit, my wife being from Washington and having grandparents and wanting to see their grandkids on a regular basis.
Okay.
That was that.
Some
that
pressure
part
there.
Of my life.
Yeah, okay.
Part of my life was covered then. And,
okay.
And plus, it was a high paying job, but little did I know that it was a high cost of living. So that matched out about, I didn't live any better in Washington, D.C. I lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, actually. And,
okay.
But life is no, it was expensive. It was not,
mm-hmm.
pointed out that, hey, the Endangered Species Act has teeth. That's going to make a difference in a lot of core projects and all over the country and a lot of other projects, anything with federal funding. It didn't matter what department or who was doing it. So
did you,
for that matter, we had your reclamation and BLM projects that were bad.
Right, exactly.
Involved in.
I'm just thinking about this. This is 70, 72, 73. Do you know the just in a real nutshell, the background that drove the ESA legislation to come to pass? I mean, I've got a pretty good handle on where the Wilderness Act came from, based on losses, which included Glen Canyon Dam, because folks like Brower and others figured there was no way to stop a big project if it wasn't in a national park.
Right.
But with the Wilderness Act, they could, if it was, you know, because it didn't matter what agency, it covered all agencies. So what was the foundational drive for the Endangered Species Act?
Well, it started actually with previous legislation, which was Endangered Species Conservation Act, I think it was, in 1969.
Oh, okay.
And I think there was one in 63, maybe, that was, I forget the title of it, but there were a couple of earlier versions of the Endangered Species Act of 73.
Okay.
But neither of them had any real hard and fast, you cannot destroy, disturb, harm, harass, or otherwise injure, endangered, anything that's endangered or threatened. I mean, it had no teeth, until 73.
Okay.
And basically, it did have teeth in that, and this was one of the visible things that had caught people's eye, that people were importing. There were a lot of really, you know, iconic animals around the world that were declining because they were being shipped around, harvested, and imported for, you know, some odd purpose, be it ivory tusk or tiger claws or what, teeth or whatever. And so it was the international component of those early acts kind of stopped the international, or it didn't stop, but it made it more difficult to move and trade stuff around. And that's where the CITES, Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, that came along about the same time, and that helped stop. If you're a signatory to CITES, you had to have basically the laws to regulate importation of wildlife. And so the Endangered Species Act covered that, but it also covered any federal funding. It didn't stop private funding, but if you have any federal nexus in there, then you had a way to have the project stop and look at what you're doing and the impact it's going to have on this endangered species or threatened species before you do it. So, but
you
those
know,
earlier acts, it was a buildup, the 73 Act culmination.
It's interesting because I look at these things, I look at NEPA and ESA, Clean Water Act, as you mentioned.
Yep.
And I look at all the stuff that was done before them.
Yeah, yeah.
And go, oh my gosh. I mean,
kind
of a day late and a dollar short here, but you know, better something than nothing. But
by the way, just today, 31st of August, the snail darter, which is one of the early sentinels of and one of the early lightning bolts in the endangered species program. Today, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed the delisting of the snail darter because it's recovered.
Okay.
So we've got another one that qualifies for coming off the list because it has recovered because of two things, the Endangered Species Act and some of the recovery actions taken there, but also because of the Clean Water Act.
Okay.
And I think people frequently overlook the Clean Water Act, but it played a significant role in making things better in aquatic systems.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did for a lot of things, it prevented them from ever being listed because they cleaned up the water pollution problems to the point that they recovered and didn't need to be listed. But and we're seeing some things. I cannot explain the apparent recovery of some things. And things are a couple of river systems in the southeast. I know fairly well their things are bouncing back. And it's like, I can only explain that through Clean Water Act, maybe. But the thing that's sad about that, it's taken 50 years. For that turnaround. So I think sometimes people think if we had some legislation, we could stop this. Well, stopping it's one thing, but the recovery process, ecosystems don't heal overnight,
right?
Especially aquatic systems,
right?
And we're still seeing things in the southeast that suffer from some of the pollution problems that existed in the past, and we still have some point source problems too. I mean, there's, you know, every now and then there's chicken processing plants, and there's things that go on that in the southeast that. There's a lot of chicken farming here, and they take the manure and the sawdust and wood chips that they put in the chicken house floors. They take all that out, and they spread it over the land. You think, well, that's great. Well, it is until they put so much of it on the land, and you get a front come through like the storm we just had that might dump 3 to 4 inches of rain in North Georgia. Well, a lot of that winds up washing the creek, and it's just puts the ammonia levels through the roof, and that just kills the hell out of everything.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, it's but Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act, they both took a long time to get on the books, but in 1970s, it took a decade, basically, to get them to that point. And I guess Clean Water Act actually had its roots in the Water Pollution Control Administration that was created, I think, in the late 1940s, 1948.
Okay.
So there's one that took another, from 48 to 72 before you had the culmination of legislation that actually had some meaningful teeth in it. But it was a beginning, and it got there eventually. It's just taken us a while.
All right, so you ended up, you decided to go ahead and take this job with the Endangered Species Office under Fish and Wildlife Service in the spring of 1974?
That would be August of, or September the 3rd, 1974, day after Labor Day.
Okay. For the Endangered...
In the Endangered Species Office.
Right, all right. What I'm thinking, maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history interview, because I'm going to want to know a whole bunch of questions about, you know, that job and why, you know, what was more lucrative to it besides DC and family versus teaching, because it sounded like teaching was something you really enjoyed doing.
Oh, I did.
So what was the trade-off there? And then what were some of the things that came up right away in the ESA office that you would have had to then dig right into.
Yeah.
So
well, it'll be fun to do that one with you because, my first one was Western Trouts, actually.
Okay, great.
So we'll pick that up next time around.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. All right, so with that, this will conclude part 3 of a Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Williams. Today is Tuesday, August 31st, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you.